try and see. Is it going? There it's going.
It says it's recording.
Okay.
I'm gonna speak.
Okay. Today is November the 16th, 2011, and we're interviewing Dr. or Mr.
Larry
Christensen and in Gimli, Manitoba. And the interviewer is B. Cherniak. And we'll start by asking Mr. Christensen,
Larry,
how your career in the grain industry began. So background, basically.
Okay, well, I was down in the States, or Helen and I. She had helped me financially get my PhD in economics at the University of Wisconsin. And then we went from there to South Dakota. And I had been there 5 years and had an offer from the University of Illinois, which was a big league compared to South Dakota. But we had decided that we didn't want to be American, especially in South Dakota. It's so bloody rock-ribbed Republican. And I had had my fill of Senator McCarthy and that stuff at the University of Wisconsin. Anyway, we wanted to get away from the Americans, and so at that time there weren't many jobs in Canada, but I heard about this one at the Wheat Board, and which was quite a jump from the academic world into the big world of grain. And anyway, I took a big salary cut to get back. And at that time, the Wheat Board had 800 employees, and there were three people with college degrees. Yeah. And the whole so it was an interesting experience. What had happened was and this goes back to 1935, when the Wheat Board was first established, the grain trade controlled it all till 1935, and then the board took it over, and the board hired the people from the grain trade. You see?
Okay.
So the people I was working with were these hard-nosed, uneducated but smart grain trader, and they were very suspicious of me, this academic guy. What the hell was he up to? So it took a little while.
What was the job description of the job that you came back for?
The job I came back to was director of statistics and economics. And then within a year or so, I was made executive assistant, was secretary to the board, and then executive assistant. And then within 5 years, I was on the board itself. So I was a board member for 30 years,
okay,
which is the longest, I think, tenure of anybody. Had a pretty high turnover. People weren't there for very long before they got into trouble. Anyway.
When you went to the, we're going to back up.
Yeah, okay.
Do a little detail on the way through, yeah. But just before I forget this question. So when you were appointed to the board at that point?
No, the board itself hired the staff.
Mm-hmm.
So they appointed me as the director of statistics and economics.
Okay.
And then promoted me.
Okay.
And then the government appoints the board members.
Okay.
And Mitchell Sharp was the minister responsible for the Wheat Board. And he was the minister that appointed me to the board.
Okay. That's the route. So let's go back to when you came to the Wheat Board, and that was in 19... 19-
59.
1959. And that was the director of statistics
and economics.
And economics. So could you describe a typical day, what that job was about?
Well, there were several things. I was in charge of putting out the annual report. I wound up writing all the speeches, not only for the commissioners, but for the ministers often that were. And then when we were starting or trying to start new programs, I'd get involved in that, and transportation and so on. So it covered a whole gamut of everything from the transportation to the sales end.
So at the wheat board, you would interact with all the directors of the different departments?
Oh yeah. They'd come out in for the, we had a staff meeting every morning at 9:30 in the boardroom for about an hour.
Okay.
And there were about seven or eight who would meet with us.
So even though, as you say, you were promoted up and up and up until you ended up on the board, what was the changes in the job in the time you were there before to the board?
Not a heck of a lot. You know, I just said it. It changed the name. The secretary, of course, had some fairly defined tasks, mm-hmm. which I quickly farmed out and kept on doing what I was had been doing. But,
and what did you enjoy as you were moving up and they were changing the name? What did you enjoy about the job the most?
Well, it was pretty exciting to be. Well, first of all, one of the really enjoyable things was the chief commissioner at the time, a guy by the name of Bill McNamara, and you'd have him on that. And he was a fantastic guy with a grade 8 education, Irishman, but boy, for a smart guy, and wonderful to work with. And then working with him and international meetings and negotiating with the Russians and those sorts of things, that was the most one, I guess.
What years did that span?
Well, that was from 59 to 64. By about 63, they trusted me enough to put me in charge of making a sale. And because here was this egghead that didn't know anything. Anyway, I was down in Peru. But that was really an exciting time.
Now, did you go to Peru to do this?
I have an expert on government financing from Ottawa with me.
Mm-hmm.
I negotiated with with three generals.
Oof.
They were the funniest bunch. I was down there for about 2 weeks. And always mañana, mañana, and I'd phone in, and how's it going? I'd say, well, getting there. And finally I get a call, they're ready to sign the contract. And but to get into the castle, called at the castle where the Peruvian cabinet met, you had to have a flag for the ambassador's flag to get in. So I called the ambassador, the Canadian ambassador, and told him I was desperate. I had to get his car to get into this. And he blew up at me because I had interrupted his nap. And I don't think he had I mean, it must have been a very quiet post or something. I wasn't used to anything like this. Anyway, I quieted him down and we got to the general. And I was sitting at a table, big table, waiting for them. And here come these these generals striding and making a lot of noise. And I damn near giggled out loud. What the hell is a joker from Gimli doing here was the thought that went through my head. But anyway, they signed the contract. It was 200,000 tons and 162.87 a ton.
Whoa.
But, and then I called McNamara and he said, what? You see, they had sent me because nobody had been able to get through there. You got it in your hot little hand, he said. So that really got me going in the sales end of it, which mm-hmm. is where all the action is.
And then you dealt with the Russians also?
Oh, yeah. A lot. And probably the biggest... I'm not absolutely sure of this, but I think the biggest single sale in Canadian history, I'll show it to you. It's crazy, too. But these are things you can't talk about, you know, when you're on the job. I'll get the coffee.
Okay, that would be great. Mr. Christensen has gone to get a document to show to us.
Did you talk to Frank Rowan by any chance?
Yes.
He was with me on this thing.
That was an exciting time in his career, too.
Yeah. Well, what happened was the Afghan War was involved in this. But that was when the Russians were... on the side of the Afghans or something.
Right, yes.
The Russians, the Americans didn't want us dealing with these terrible communists. And, but we knew that the Russians wanted the wheat. And we knew that or were pretty damn sure that the Americans would get over this nonsense within a year or so and would be in there. So we wanted to get in there first. So we met the head of the Russian Wheat Board in Paris on a weekend. Flew in there. Nobody knew anything about this. And here is what we agreed to. You know, the bare bones of it.
And you signed it?
And we signed it.
Mm-hmm.
And then a year later, when it was, what do you call it? Acceptable.
Official.
Yeah, acceptable. And then we made it into an official contract with exactly what
it was written here. So
yeah.
Just so I can describe, Mr. Christensen has brought out a document that has the contract with the Russians in Russian, from March 1981, but down below is your handwriting, I believe, was basically the contract that they agreed upon the year before, and they both signed, and then the official document came a year later, and it was what was written down the year before.
Identical to what we had agreed to. The sale, in effect, was consummated in 1980,
right?
But we couldn't say anything about it till 1981.
Exactly, a year later, March 1980 to March 1981.
Yeah. But then of course the Americans, by that time Americans were real anxious to sell to the Russians, and we had sold them up for 5 years.
Right. 5 years, that's great.
But that was probably my most exciting sale. But Frank Rowan was, his initials are on here too.
Well, I think you signed it in the...
And Pershing, yeah. I guess that was all that was signed, but Frank was with me.
So what is this up here that says something quality?
Minimum.
Minimum qual...
Minimum quantity, 5 million tons per year, excluding Cuban requirements. We were selling the Russians wheat that went to Cuba.
Okay.
So we didn't want to lose, I mean, we didn't mm-hmm. want that to count. And wheat and feed wheat, oats and barley, so they could interchange the mm-hmm. crops. And our best endeavor is to supply a minimum of 2 million tons of feed grain of that 5 million. Mm-hmm. Because we couldn't promise them for sure that we'd have 2 million tons of barley. And then what was the next one?
Meet twice.
Twice a year, October and November, to negotiate the actual terms, the price. Huh? The time period.
Starting in January 1981 for 5 years. So that's a very nice piece of work to have to remember.
Yeah. But that sort of thing never, you couldn't talk about it, obviously, you know.
And did you take a interpreter with you?
No, not with the Russians. Pershing just spoke perfect English. But when I was in China, I was at an interpreter. They spoke English too, but...
But you had.
But they pretended sometimes they didn't.
didn't quite understand? Got me,
yeah.
To, I'll just put this
just put it all
right here.
Yeah.
So in your time period, who were our biggest trading customers at that time?
Oh, Russia.
Russia.
Yeah, well, yeah.
So you've Peru, Russia, China.
Oh, Peru wasn't all that big. That was only 200,000 tons. You know, this was a big big league.
Yes.
And China was always in the millions of tons. But that was interesting too. And Helen came, her daughter came with me 1 year, but it always took 3 weeks. To negotiate a deal. And we were always so frustrated. Jerry Vogel, I'd go with him. He was the chief commissioner. And it was always so frustrating until it suddenly dawned on us that it was very similar 1 year to the next. You know, and then after about the third year, we realized that they had a must have a textbook on how to negotiate. Day one, you do this. Day two, and then we were able to live with it for the next 5 years.
Were there any other countries that you did sales to yourself?
Well, all over the place. But those were the biggies.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the sales, of course, were done through the trade.
What would that mean?
Well, we'd sell to the trade, and the trade sold to the.
So when you say the trade, you mean like a.
The private companies, the Pattersons.
Okay.
They were relatively small on the export side, but Bunge and Cargill, and they were bigger. Now, anticipating your question, I think the reason we did that was that there were some countries that preferred to deal with the private trade, and some countries that preferred to deal with what they considered to be the state organization. So where there was a active private trade in a country, mm-hmm. that tended to be serviced by our private trade.
Okay. Yes, that was my question. You were right. The other part of my question was who you interacted with inside and outside the Canadian Wheat Board. Well, you've now told me that you interacted with other countries and with the private brokerage houses.
Yeah, and then there's a whole problem of grain transportation, which I haven't dealt with. But
well, let's talk about that for a bit then.
I was cleaning out my desk, and the day, a few weeks after I retired, I was asked to give an address to the Alberta Wheat Pool, and it summarizes all that stuff there. So, if you promise to return it, I'll let you have it. But it goes through all the
mm-hmm.
all the rigmarole.
Well, that would be wonderful. We'll make a copy,
mm-hmm.
and I guess mail it back to you.
Yeah.
And
but you see, grain transportation was a very, very big problem in Canada. And there were times when there were ships lined up in Vancouver, and we had the sails, and we couldn't get it out to the ports. And
because of the railway?
Yeah. Well, it was always a fight about whose fault it was. And one winter, or one year, it was just when Jarvis became chief commissioner. But I was getting so frustrated that we had these 19 ships waiting in Vancouver for grain, and we could sell everything we had.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing would move, so I called in the lawyer one morning and I said, Henry, can we, the board, buy some hopper cars? Well, he said, Larry, leave that with me. So he comes back in a few days and he said, yeah, you can. There's a clause in the Wheat Board Act that says that you can't buy an elevator. But it's because it's a fixed asset. But rolling stock, you can't. So, but Jarvis was new to the job, and he was Ottawa oriented, and so afraid to make any tough decisions right away. So anyway, I got the board to go along with buying 2,000 hopper cars. And that was like an enema, you know, the whole system opened up, because then the provinces said, oh my God, and they each bought one. And Otto Lang, he came through with 8,000, and all of a sudden the grain started moving. But I wound up in court, and the only time in my life, in Regina, one Friday afternoon. Somebody comes in and puts something on my desk, and I didn't know what this was all about, and I was supposed to be in court in Regina on Monday, and the farm group in Southern Saskatchewan. I didn't think the board had the right to do this. But Henry had written the act. So, I mean,
what was Henry's last name?
Monk.
Henry Monk.
Yeah. He wrote the Canadian Wheat Board Act, so there was no question that we won the suit. But there was an awful lot of politics and hassling back and forth, and all always the railways claiming it wasn't their fault, and the terminals that say it wasn't their fault, and you know, it just went round and round and round.
Now, when the, I don't know if this question is quite in the sequence, but it made me think of it when you were talking about the ships sitting out in Vancouver. When in your experience did the grain start going west instead of east? Because the beginning of this project, of course, was originated in Thunder Bay because it used to be such a major port, and then things changed. Can you talk about what happened there?
Do you really want to know?
Yeah, I do. Really do.
Well, when the Helen told me about the call, I thought, oh, oh, I'm going to have to tell them something they don't want to hear. see, Thunder Bay is obsolete. The way to move grain from the prairies is to move it directly to Quebec City or Montreal, Halifax, Churchill, or Vancouver. Because what you're doing with Thunder Bay is you're bringing the grain in there, unloading it, inspecting it, well, you know all this, and then they have to load it again, take it down to St. Lawrence, and load it, and unload. It's an extra movement. So the logical thing to do is to have unit trains that go straight through
port.
To the port. But it's a gradual process. It'll get there, but it's very slow.
I know that someone else we interviewed talked about once you get it onto the boat, your transportation costs are way, way less.
No. The marginal cost is much lower than the average cost, to use the economist jargon.
Mm-hmm. And so to this date, I imagine most of the grain goes to Vancouver.
No. Well, I don't know now. I mean, I've been retired since 1990, that's 20 years. So I don't know what the breakdown is, but it was at that time I left was shifting to more and more to Vancouver.
Okay. There's so many questions to ask you. What would you like people to know most about the work that you did? And that would be a comment on the
you mean in my obituary?
No, now. Not in your obituary, now.
I guess what I'd like them to know is that I was working for the farmer. Mm-hmm. No, I didn't give a damn about Ottawa. My job, I was being paid by them. You see, and I could, it's a tricky relationship because you're appointed by one entity and being paid by another group. Well, Ottawa has the final word. I mean, they're the government of the country. But, I mean, I've always felt that the farmer should be the and so, you know, I always brought that to the fore in every meeting I was in. Which didn't make me very popular with the private grain trade, for example, because I was always fighting for a bigger share of the pie for the farmer.
Did the, in all the years you mentioned being on the board for 30 years, how did you survive all those appointments and governments? And
well, it wasn't easy. No, it's... You have to know when to keep quiet and when to charge. Well, the farmers' union used to get after me for not being more vocal, you know. But being vocal, you could be a big hero one day. And your usefulness to the farmer is finished. So it was always a judgment call of how much to say and when and so on.
How many governments did you serve under then?
12 or 13. Not governments, but ministers.
Yeah.
You see, some governments would have more than...
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that over the years, at varying times, there was differing degrees of interference. There were years, perhaps,
and some chief commissioners were better than others in terms of telling the ministers to go to hell. But McNamara was very good at that. And they respected him for it. Mitchell Sharp, for example, who was a very good friend of McNamara's. And Jarvis, when he came from Ottawa, he tended to kowtow to the minister, which was his background. He had been in government service all his life. And he wasn't used to arguing with the minister, but he got over it. He was very good at the end.
Okay, the next question is, what might surprise people most about the work that you did? But they wouldn't.
I suppose these sorts of things. I mean, most people don't
have no idea how these million...
How big this is. I mean...
The $1 million deals with the...
hundreds of millions, you know.
Yes.
In the private sector, that would... You can just imagine what your salary would be if you...
Mm-hmm.
Came home with a contract like that.
So the next part is just talking about the interconnectedness of the Canadian Wheat Board with other major components of the industry. And as you can see here, we've got the grain companies, and you talked about sometimes it went through the grain company, sometimes not.
Yeah, depended. That was strictly up to the buyer's wishes. You're always there to please the buyer. And if the buyer wanted to buy it this way, we were there with that.
And I, over the 30 years, your career spanned how many years?
30, yeah.
30. I know you were on the board for...
25 was on the board.
25 on the board, okay. What kind of changes did you see in the composition of the grain companies? Did they increase in numbers, decrease?
Oh, no. That's an interesting thing, too. The number of grain elevators, I think it was over 5,000 when I came there. And I don't know how many there are now, but probably there'll be around 100 or less.
Mm-hmm.
And the staff, and that was one of the things I did. Personnel reported to me directly. And one of the things I was pushing all the time I was there was to cut down on the number of staff. There were 800 when we came, and I noticed that people that don't have enough to do are always mad at each other, and so you get rid of them, you know. But the other side, the flip side is, then you can afford to pay them well. And you know, have very good benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the best daycare, and that was another thing I got into trouble with, in Winnipeg.
I didn't know that.
Just before I left.
It was a daycare at the...
Right in the board, yeah. And it's just a wonderful thing because, well, what had happened was that the staff was decreasing in number and we had that space. So I said, well, let's not rent it out. Let's use it for daycare. And a couple of the guys, it was 3-2, the vote, a couple of the board members thought, oh, this, the hell is this organization coming to babysitting? And anyway, it's been a wonderful thing for morale.
That is wonderful. And I would think over the years, the number of grain companies, as you mentioned.
Yeah, I was trying to remember the numbers there.
A lot of merging going on, that's for sure, lately.
Yeah, and of course, in the last few years, it's been just a massive consolidation.
But do you say it's in the last 5-10 years that the really major gobbling up of each other has happened?
Yeah, when the co-ops folded, that was the end of it for the farmer. And that's a story that isn't told. I think that the wealthy grain farmers on the boards of the co-ops saw an opportunity to make more money by privatizing, and they just sold it out. You know, the concept of working together went out the window.
And I guess now...
And now it's even more so because not only is working together out the window, we gave it all away to the International Grain Company with no... I mean, Canada had a real strong bargaining position in the grain market and gave it away and got nothing in terms of trade concessions from the Americans. And... It's unbelievable.
When would you pinpoint that happening? Because, of course, now the big controversy with the wheat board being disbanded, you feel that it happened even before now.
That has an eroding process for the last 20 years. It was going on. Well, that was one of the things that I got into a fight with Charlie Mayer on. He wanted to... take barley away from the board. He took oats and then said, that wasn't a precedent. And then the next year he was around barley. But he was just dead set on dismantling the board. And he knew he couldn't get a vote in favor of it. And he wanted the board to say it was okay, you see. But there's a, if you're a big wealthy farmer, there's a case to be made that you're going to do better without the board. Because, maybe you are smarter than the average bear. Maybe you are able to get the top of the market. But there's no question that the farmers as a group are much worse off financially. And there have been studies on this, Andy Smith and others, on the return. But the big farmers gain control of the thing, and it's good capitalism.
So
it's working.
So What do you think now with the, right now, 2011, the wheat board being disbanded and all the farmers feeling like they're independent business people with their computers and they're going to be grain traders? Where do you see this in 5, 10 years?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are things they can do. For example, in grain transportation, with their computers. Leo, my brother, and I argued that country elevators were obsolete, that all that the country elevator did was to load a grain into a hopper car. And so why are you building these great bejesus monuments all over the prairies? What you should do is hook up with the bigger producers and have producer cars and loading platforms, well-equipped loading platforms that could load a whole train load. And you wouldn't need the country elevator system. But that's very popular, too.
So if we have all the individual farmers now selling their grains, what would the one theme that I've heard from everyone I've interviewed was that they were very proud to be selling Canadian grain because it was the gold standard and you knew what you were delivering. And that
That's not going to be there anymore. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things. Churchill's not going to be there anymore either. I mean, there are things like that. That.
Mm-hmm. Well, carrying on here. Again, this was the describing the interconnectedness of the wheat board to producers. And you were saying in your work you saw your job being representing the producers?
Yeah, that's right. And we had meetings with the farmers out in the country. And in January and February we'd go out and, in the small towns and let them pound away at us, you know, for a whole day. And that was fun. But that was something we put in a long time ago.
Do you think they still do that?
I don't know. They may. I think they would have had a hard time not doing it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have touched on the carriers, the rail and water. Mm. The interconnectedness, and it sounds like at times it was a challenge.
Yeah, and there's the banks too.
Okay, let's do the rail and water carriers, and then we'll move on to the banks.
Well, with the water carrier, the wheat board was a very, very big customer for their fleet. I see. So we'd have a negotiation twice a year, as I recall, for the rate for the year. We had a very good relationship with that with the Lake Fleet.
What companies would be involved in the
Canadian? The Canada Steamship Lines was the big one. And there were several small ones that have two or three lake vessels, but there was another big one that I can't recall. Canada Steamship was owned by Paul Martin.
Mm-hmm. Patterson got into
it. Yeah, they were in it. Oh, yeah, that's right. And Parrish and Heimbach were, I think.
those would be the main ones that you would...
Well, that I can recall. 20 years ago now.
Now, let's talk about the banks, because, of course...
Well, I was just going to touch on them, that at one time, the Wheat Board was the biggest borrower of funds in, that the banks had. And the banks would decide what the interest rate would be. And they'd tell us. I mean, it was just crass. But then we got... somebody had the bright idea one day that we should go and see the credit unions and see whether we couldn't do a little better. And that shook the whole thing. And we started getting a much more reasonable rate. But the big ones, they just goes in like that.
Because at some point, the Wheat Board did become the insurers for farmers when... My understanding was when there was too much grain or there wasn't enough grain, but that the Wheat Board then would pay them and they would deliver the grain later.
Yeah, it was a program called the cash advances, and they'd get 60% or 80% of the value of the grain, and then get the balance when they delivered it. That was to carry them over when they couldn't deliver the whole thing. Or sometimes none, you know, depending on how tough the marketing was that year. But that was another program and I don't know what's happened to that, whether that, or who will run it if there is still a program like that. Because, I mean, the physical things haven't changed. Everybody is still going to want to deliver their grain right at harvest time. There's going to be congestion again, and somebody has to sort it all out, but it's going to be fun to watch.
Now, I don't know who they would mean on this questionnaire. They got handlers. What would they mean by handlers?
Well, you see, you've got two kinds of grain companies. You've got the export side and the country elevator side.
Okay.
And what they're talking about is the country elevator side.
Okay, and I guess you had people that worked with the country grain elevators too?
Oh, yeah, we had our country, well, that's the Flexible Fred's department.
Do you want to say anything more about that department?
Well, not much, except that his staff was never very happy with him.
Oh,
he was a pompous guy. I guess he was efficient enough, but he could have done it more humanely, I thought.
Okay, well then, let's move on to the Canadian Grain Commission, where my father worked.
Yeah, well...
What was that relationship?
Oh, that was just absolutely wonderful, you know, all through the years. And, oh, that's another one. We got together with them and set up the Canada Greens, I mean, the Institute. And now, you know, that shows how well we work together. And we got that organized in a day. And what's his name? Owns the Ottawa Senators. Anyway.
Is he still alive?
Yeah, well, yeah. He was an executive assistant to Otto Lang. And anyway, I was always giving a bad time about how slow Ottawa was getting things done. So I said I bet him $100 that he couldn't get this through in a couple of days or so. And he got it through, got a cabinet approval, and away we went. That was Shuttleworth was commissioner, and Vic Martins. I notice he's still alive. But that's an example of we never had any fights or any problem at all. I don't know whether they saw it that way from their end, but.
Well, and then when the next one is researchers, so that would probably have also been. Did you have a research branch at the Wheat Board, or was that the Canadian Grains Institute?
No, that would be the Grains Institute, yeah.
Okay. So that was a semi-independent body from the Wheat Board?
Mm-hmm. Well, completely. I mean, we never interfered with anything there. We put up money, but didn't. And that was it's been a very successful organization. You see, when you're selling wheat, it's not like selling cars where you can go out and advertise. I mean, it just doesn't work. But with our thinking on the institute was that if you work up a relationship with a serial chemist, and are working with them in these big markets, they become your salesman within their own country, showing them that this is the wheat to buy.
And were there a lot of new strains and grains that were developed in your time?
Well, that's a different. That's not the Grain Commission, and it's not the Wheat Board. That's the university. No, the big one. Well, wheat was always being gradually improved, and barley, but the big breakthrough was on canola. It seemed that when canola first came out, it would have this problem or that problem, and the plant breeders would say okay, and next year or two they breed it out, and it's improved and it's improved, and it's been a wonderful thing for Western Canada. But I'm still growing. When I was there, they said it'll never go over 6 million acres, but last figure I saw was something like 14. Mm. So, but that was an Icelander that did that, Balder Stefansson. Mm.
The next question is your sense of the role you and the Wheat Board played in Canada's success as an international grain trader?
Well, I guess the measure of our success is what percentage of the world grain market we got. I mean, that was our number one job. And we hung in there at about 22 to 24%, regardless of how much export subsidy the Americans threw at us. And partly we did it by this sort of maneuvering, that we would look for places that we could get ahead of them. And
do the Americans have an equivalent of a wheat board, or are they?
No, they had that's another thing, part of my job. We used to meet with the Americans, the Australians, and the Argentines. They had quarterly meetings when I was first there. and they gradually decreased from quarter to twice a year and then once a year. But we meet to discuss mutual problems. And never got so far as to talk about or agree to setting the price. We could have. And they had an organization called the Commodity Credit Corporation that controlled their big surpluses of grain. And they could have said it, but we could never talk them into it. That would have been fun.
And they, of course, my sense was they also didn't have as uniform or as the checks and balances that we had through our grain commission as to the quality of the
grain
delivered.
Nowhere close. Nowhere close.
What role will the Grain Commission have when the wheat board's gone then? Will they still
I don't know how they're going to shake this all out, but it's going to make it easier. You see, it's in the interest of a private grain trader to beat the rules if they can. And so, without the wheat board and the grain commission working together, I don't know whether it's going to make their job a lot harder or not. But again, it's not something that they want to discuss publicly.
Mm-hmm. Well, the next section, and we've certainly covered a lot of it, is changes that. Just this is an overview of the major changes that you saw in the industry in your career. Can you summarize that very briefly?
Yeah, that's it.
I'll note for the record that we have an address to the Alberta Pool Meeting in 1991, and where that's the topic, and we are going to have a copy of that. So maybe you could just give us one or two highlights. Well, I'll give it back to you.
Well, here I talk about the system when I got there, and then the transportation system, because that's what the farmers, how they interact with the trade. So it's basically what I'm talking about is what we've already covered, that there were 5,500 country elevators, and that it used to be that the system was so disorganized that if the wheat board ordered 2,000 cars to go to Vancouver of number one northern, they'd send the shipping orders to the private grain companies, and they might get 1,000. And then they'd get 500 of barley and 200 of rye, whatever suited the grain company to create space in their country elevator. So we had to devise what was called the block shipping system to correct this, and that was one of the big changes that.
So the block system would be what?
Well, it's just an organizational device. I mean, you divide the prairies into blocks, and you'd allocate so many blocks, so many cars to the different blocks, and then break it down to companies, and you tallied it every week and knew exactly how much you were getting and when you were getting it.
Okay.
It was Jim Liebfried was the one that wrote that on.
was he at the university when you were at the university in the States?
Jim?
Yeah.
No, he was my student at North Dakota, South Dakota.
Okay, so
he
was, because I remember interviewing him and he talked about being in the States, so that's why I asked that.
Yeah, he's an American. Mm-hmm. And I got the board to hire him soon after I got on the board.
He's still here.
He's still here, yeah. He's one of the... Well, this goes into a fair amount of detail about how the shipping system was.
So there were changes in the shipping system?
Yeah, big changes. And then the changes at the West Coast, but on the shift that you were talking about, going from the West to the East.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the East Coast, that Thunder Bay is obsolete, only I don't say so. And then Quebec, the rise of Quebec City and Montreal. And there's 4 points of what I think we need. A country, this is 1990, you've got to go back to. A country collection system that fully integrates farm stored grain into country elevator system, whereby farmers are paid for to store grain on the farm in exchange for which they guarantee prompt delivery of that grain. Continued expansion of terminal capacity at the West Coast and the commencement of planning of a new terminal, acquisition of 1,000 to 1,500 hopper cars a year, creation of grain cleaning capacity at Montreal and Quebec to enable the grain to be shipped eastward directly to export positions. And then it went to GATT. And
what's GATT?
General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. It's an agreement on. Well, and here's what we recommended be done to the board. So I've tried to look ahead as to what we needed in grain transportation and selling. And the structure of the board. You see, we were all appointed then. And we recommended that we elected, which they did.
Is it still a combination of appointments and elections?
The government appoints just about half of them, and the rest are elected. And the ones that are elected vote one way, and the government votes the other way.
Dear. Okay. Well, the other question was, looking over your career, what was the major challenge that the Wheat Board faced over your career, over those years?
Well, its existence, I guess.
Yeah, it's a pretty big one.
Yeah, I mean, that's accurate, especially in the latter part of my career. Helen will attest to the fact that I'd come home pretty discouraged sometimes about what they were going to do to the Wheat Board. And they finally got away with it.
So you had to live in Winnipeg during those years.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were in there. And then we moved down to our place on the lake. About 6 years, and that was kind of desolate in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. So we move here in the winter, we go south in the winter, and then back north in the summer. Which is a good life.
That's good. Now, are there any other interesting stories that you think might be good for the record, or?
Well, Helen was involved in quite a bit of this, you know. one of the things that got changed was that we were away so much of the year traveling that I got the board to agree to pay the travel expenses of the wife for one trip a year, which was very, very good for the family, and it was also good for the board, because we were having these big formal dinners with the big shots coming in, you know, and so they'd have the background.
And,
mm-hmm.
And also we had five kids, so it was nice for me to get away.
But she
very nice.
I mentioned that she had come to China one year, and we toured for 3 weeks or something. And we had a Chinese interpreter. No, well you tell it. What were our interpreters?
Oh, when we got there, they decided that that we should have a French interpreter because we were from Canada. Didn't realize we were Icelandic and certainly didn't speak French. So they had a French interpreter and an English interpreter who actually didn't speak much English because she was so happy that she could learn English from us. So it was rather a very strange, we called them Willie and Nilly. No, Willie and Dilly. Willie was the guy and Dilly, they were so funny, honestly. But we got along fine with them.
Well, I was so worried that you were going to burst out laughing at the wrong time.
And I did, quite a bit of the time too, because, you know, they would say things that were just, they were just so funny. And Bonnie was with us.
Yeah.
Our 16-year-old daughter was learning Chinese at the time. So they invited her along, paid her expenses. That was quite a trip for her. We still laugh about that trip. Oh, my goodness, that was so much fun. And that was in 73, you know, before there
Yeah,
were
that
there.
Was Chairman Mao, you know, that was really tough.
Oh, no, that was a different time from now. Have you been over? No.
No.
But a lot of people, of course, go now, and it's quite a different place. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, they're taking over the world, aren't they?
Well, financially.
What were you just telling me this morning about Africa?
They're controlling most of the economic development in Africa.
In Africa, isn't that amazing, eh? The Chinese.
See, our daughter is over there.
They're really...
Well, the American biggest debt is to China.
To China?
China
has changed so much, eh? Wow.
Now, you must have had a challenge, as you said, traveling all the time with your job and raising five children mainly on your own.
Well, yes, yeah, that was tough because he would be gone a lot, not often 3 weeks at a time.
Well, it was the Chinese one was the worst one
because
it was always 3 weeks.
It was so long, yeah.
I was thinking of building a summer cottage over there.
lots of stories, but when you were telling them, I started laughing when I heard you telling them about the weekend you spent in Paris, because wasn't that the time that, was it Frank that was with you and got a boil on his rear end?
No, no.
Was that a different trip?
That was a different trip. We were on our way to South Yemen.
South Yemen. Oh,
that was
fun. And you had to stay in Paris or something.
Yeah, Ed and I. But he got this terrible boil on his ass.
You can imagine they traveling with that. Well, you're sitting all the time.
That was one sale we didn't make.
So are there any questions that I should have asked you and I didn't, that you can think of? That should be for the record, and you'd like people to know, and because you bring a real wealth of experience to this.
Oh, I was going to tell you, have you seen our annual report?
Nope. You'll have coffee before you go, won't you? It's a quick cup?
Well, I don't drink coffee, but you do.
There's decaf. Do you drink decaf?
Oh, I don't drink. I've never had a cup of coffee in my life.
Oh, is that right? What about tea? Will you have tea, though?
Sure.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Oh, no, that's great.
You haven't lived in the company of Icelanders before.
My goodness, it looks like an encyclopedia.
Well, it is. But this is the annual reports of the report, and I've got the set, complete set back to I don't know when. But every year, the whole thing is here, including quite a narrative of exactly what happened during the year.
Was this the kind of report you wrote every year?
Yeah.
So you wrote many of these?
No, I got promoted.
Oh.
I supervised it for quite a few years.
Okay.
But for, you know, like different programs and are all described in here and everything the board does. International Wheat Agreement, the sales policy for the year, the St. Lawrence Seaway. This was the opening of the Seaway in 59. This would be of interest to you. But, there are all kinds of changes that were instituted for the year. And then the changes in the pricing. See, at that time, prices were only quoted in Store Thunder Bay.
Okay.
No, because it all...
Right there.
Yeah.
Port Arthur at that time, wasn't
Port
it?
Port Arthur, yeah. Port
Arthur.
Yeah, it's Fort William, Port Arthur. But the government programs that were in effect that year. And
so it's a very good history.
It's a complete history. So if I'm sure you there are.
Well, we'll write it down and talk about the fact that that would be a good resource to have.
Well, Dave Suderman would be familiar with that because I'm sure he wrote some of them.
Yes, he mentioned that he had
a
hand in writing many of them.
Yeah. I see Honorable Gordon Churchill was the minister that year. Oh, yeah, and then you have years like 68, when 380 million bushels of grain were tough and damp.
Ooh.
And had to be dried. And there won't be enough dryers in the country to dry them.
So they had a lot of rotten grain?
Well, no. I shouldn't say there weren't in there weren't enough at the terminals to dry it. But the pools had enough. But they kept saying, well, no, it'll take care of itself. And finally, in about March, they got off their ass and started drying. And saved it all. But if they hadn't, it would have been a real disaster. Because once it started eating, then. But the terminals didn't have, and that's part of the early days, part of the trouble at Vancouver was lack of drying capacity. But anyway, I wanted you to know
that's
this thing existed, and I'm sure this
that's
is my
copy
sort of thing.
I was actually hoping you'd take some.
Oh, I don't think so.
The Bible.
That's right. Well, I guess this ends the formal part of our discussion.
Yeah.
And I want to thank you very much, and I feel that you've really added some new important details to our study.
Well, you must have to sift through a lot of stuff.
I wish I could tell you about
I just get to do the interviews. I don't have to sift
through it. Edited, is that what it's called? Yeah. I guess.